This is the show where John and Gary died and went to Automotive Conference Heaven, and we'll tell you all about it in just a minute.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Hyundai. See what makes Elantra so nice. Check out its style, interior space, fuel economy, and popular features now.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy, episode 253 for August 7th, on the shores of advanced automotive technology. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Well, I'd call this Automotive Conference Heaven, wouldn't you?
Yes, pretty much. I mean, here we are sitting out looking at a golf course that's covered with brand new automobiles of various makes. There's a parasail out there in the horizon. There are people behind us enjoying a cocktail party. And here we are in Traverse City with hundreds of auto people.
Not in the studio. We're up in Traverse City where the Management Briefing Seminar is a conference that's got to be one of the longest running conferences in this business. I think it goes back to the mid-60s or
Absolutely,
something like
yeah.
that. And so here we are at this nice resort, like I said, overlooking the Traverse Bay. And that's why I'm calling it Automotive Conference 7. Now, the conference is a grueling day in, day out, 4 day, all kinds of speeches after speeches after speeches. So that may not be heaven, but it's kind of nice being out here now.
Absolutely. And we're bringing the cream of the crop of some of these presentations. Some people who made presentations here that you guys are all going to be able to see them up close and personal.
It's not a conference where you get a lot of big breaking news, stop the presses, this just came in, but lots of good little details, lots of good nuggets of information.
Which is why you and I have been coming up here for more years than we would be willing to admit.
That's right. In fact, why don't we bring in our first guest right now? And as he takes a seat here, I'll introduce him. This is Chu-Hee Lee, the deputy director of the Electronic Research Lab for Volkswagen, which is not out of Germany, but out of Silicon Valley. Isn't that right, Chu-Hee?
Yes, you're right. I came from San Francisco.
So it's great to have you on Autoline After Hours.
Yeah, my pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
So you have 140 people that are working out at ELR. You've got
ERL.
ERL, sorry.
ELR is a different, never mind.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
That's maybe it's out there. So you've got researchers, you've got social scientists, you've got people working software interfaces. Tell us about this operation and what it is you're hoping to achieve.
Yes, so we have computer scientists, you know, software engineers, mechanical engineers, electrical engineers, designers, and even psychologists in our team, where we are trying to bring innovation into our product, and we want to accelerate that process because automotive industry is known for quite a long development cycle compared to the consumer electronics. There's a good reason for that. However, we are trying to, you know, really shorten that cycle.
So this is really Volkswagen's entree into Silicon Valley. This is the way that they can keep track of what's going on
there.
You're
right. So we work for the entire Volkswagen group with all the brands that the group has. We were established in 1998, so quite a long time ago. And I joined the group in 2002 while still it was very small as a startup. Mm-hmm. And now we have more than, you know, 130 people.
So for example, in the Audi where you have Google Earth, mm-hmm. so presumably the Google campus is close to where
yes.
you guys are located, so
right.
you'd have a good working relationship with
Absolutely.
Companies like that?
Absolutely. Physical, you know, presence and the actual proximity really helps a lot. Because you have to also be able to bridge that very different world of automotive thinking versus Silicon Valley, you know, thinking. Automotive where you have to make everything to work under all circumstances with a lot of testing involved and even the regulation, while the consumer electronics, especially in the, you know, the software development, you know, you have really this as the speed of the development and the launch, which is not comparable or compatible even with the car. And the level of the quality of the expectation of the failure is also quite different. Mm-hmm. So we had to work together just to bring these two different worlds together.
So that's got to be why Audi was the first to have Google Earth as part of its navigation system, is that closeness.
Absolutely. So back in 2005, when we dreamed about having this type of connected navigation in the car, we didn't know much of from the local ERR point of view. We didn't know much of the automotive actually development. I don't come from the automotive side. I studied network system and internet technology, but throughout this development program, we were able to really understand much better our own products, the software and hardware platform, and we were able to bring even newer innovation. For example, the Street View, the Google Street View that goes with our Google navigation, we brought from the very early concept to the final actual product release about 9 months. So this type of learning and knowing the platform really helps a lot to accelerate the innovation.
In your presentation today, you mentioned that in 2007, essentially the world changed with the introduction of the iPhone. So I'm wondering, has there been as significant a development in automotive telematics or infotainment as the introduction of the iPhone?
I think from the our own research and development point of view, things already started even before, right? And like, for example, I mentioned about the Google Earth starting already in 2005. The online, server-based speech recognition also started back then. However, sometimes you have to wait a little bit to also certain technologies to mature. This type of online server technology, the company like Google needed to really also develop their own and meet the what we call as an automotive the quality. You can, being an internet company, you can also do a lot of experimental things like Google Labs. You just try out there, and then if it doesn't work, okay, then you can also take it down. But for car manufacturers, not like that. We are not going to experiment our own car on the road. Mm-hmm. Therefore, it takes a little bit longer. But with the transition of the traditional computing from phone or laptop to like a mobile, which is the 2007, I call it the changing part, because the Steve Jobs made us all to live a different type of lifestyle, helped also a lot our own connected vehicle strategy.
Mm-hmm. Is the automotive industry getting better at accelerating its product development cycle working with the electronics industry?
I think so. We are not only looking at the trend of what's happening, but we are working directly with the key players, companies like Google, like the Nvidia, who also not only making the servers services for the end user, but also those hardware that enables the software. And then we're moving into what we call modular infotainment architecture, where we also shorten the actual refreshment cycle of the in-vehicle mobile computing. So from whatever it could have taken 5 years, we can bring down almost down to 2 years now.
At your organization, are you working on autonomy as well as electronic information and infotainment?
I mean, autonomous driving.
Yes,
absolutely. So we have the infotainment topic, a lot of this connected navigation and mobile integration and so on. And the ERL is the one who worked with Stanford back in 2005 and the winner of the DARPA Grand Challenge.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember that Turek with the
right.
Stanford. So we were very proud of our the work with Stanford, and we continue that with the Urban Challenge and also the PaxPeak TTS and then so on.
Mm-hmm. So how do you see that technology rolling out? Do you think that this is going to be something that we're going to be seeing within the next several years as practical product versus the Google car, which seems to be a science project?
Yeah, there will be different stage of rolling out from what we call, let's say, partially automatic or to full the automated vehicle. We're already we're working, as was shown at the CES, this traffic jam assist, where the car can follow in the traffic jam and the parking situation. For those specialized situation, yes, we are going to see those applications earlier. For like a fully autonomous the mode, yes, it will follow. It will take us a little bit more time.
It's going to be exciting to watch that development. Chuhi, thanks so much for stopping by and bringing us up to speed with Silicon Valley's view of what's going on in the automotive industry.
Thank you so much for having me.
Very much appreciate it. Yeah.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
So what do you think, Gary? Do you think this autonomy is going to come in as fast and furious as I think it is? Or are you thinking that people are maybe starting to slow down in their optimism?
Well, I think that the technologists are pretty bullish on the technology. I think that we're going to have a situation whereby there are going to be lawyers and regulators that are probably going to be providing some roadblocks, as it were, to the implementation.
Why don't you introduce our next guest here then?
All right, so we have Han Hendricks, who's the Vice President of Advanced Product Development and Sales for JCI. And you, too, have been looking at the future.
Exactly.
And so your interest has been on the future of interiors, being a company that is concentrating on the interiors. And so you've recently launched a project to do some futuring to figure out what's going on.
Right.
So tell us
right.
about that.
Yeah, so we call our project IV25. Interior Vision 2025. And we really had three global cross-functional team with scientists and designers working on three themes that we believe are going to be very impactful to our business, the auto industry, and mobility as a whole. It's small cars in big cities, future China luxury, and the impact of autonomous driving on the interior. Because starting with the last one, we believe that in 2025, 80% of the time you spend in a vehicle, you don't have to drive anymore. You can do other things. So for us, it's important to figure out what people will do with their regained time.
Hans, you've got to love this idea that Google showed of a car with no steering wheel, no brake, no gas.
Absolutely.
But boy, talk about changing the interior.
Absolutely.
But it's a big challenge to you guys, though, because if it's not an automotive interior as we know it, then this opens up you to a variety of other competitors. So
right.
Herman Miller might become an automotive interior supplier.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's very interesting. And there are connections as well, right? Because we see, for example, an important trend with smaller cars in big cities is car ownership versus car usership that we see happen in the future. And especially with younger people who are less interested in owning a vehicle. When you are a German car buyer today, you study the brochure of your future vehicle in detail, you turn it into a PhD before you order exactly the car you want to have in the smallest detail. When you are a car user, you pick the car that is available, and you have very different requirements for the interior than the German guy specifying all the details. You want it to be smelling fresh when you enter it. So think about odor management technologies. You want it to be clean. So think about self-cleaning nanotechnology on the surfaces of the interior. So again, very different requirements in those segments.
So you're a big believer that there's going to be more car sharing. You told me yesterday that you did a calculation of the amount of time that your car is not being used.
93%. So a very inefficient model, right? 93%.
Yeah, or stated in hours, typically a car is parked for
yes.
22 hours out of a day.
Yeah, but exactly. But we see the interior becoming more and more important, and people spend more time in the interior of a vehicle going forward. So now they have the opportunity to do different things than just concentrate on the road.
So as you look forward to this day when autonomy arrives and people are not spending as much time driving, even though they're in their cars, at JCI, what are you trying to lay out, an iPad tablet in front of them, or you fill in the blank?
Yeah, so most important thing is context and what people will do, and then the solutions will follow, right? So we started our global consumer research with consumers in China, in Europe, and in North America to learn what consumers will do. And we have a mock-up that we sort of can reconfigure to try out different solutions on what use cases will happen when the driver doesn't have to drive anymore. So you can think about a work scenario where when you're going to work, you can start doing your email. You can think about a more social setting that the driver is more focused on the rest of the people in the interior, a more social setting that the interior should accommodate. Or you want to totally relax on your commute home. You turn the seat back, you have your massage function, the smart surfaces around you turn into a huge aquarium, and you're totally relaxed when you arrive at home instead of the stressful commute back home.
I want to live in the future.
So let's bring this back closer to right now. Now, one of the lines that you said in your presentation, and maybe this is an exaggeration, but you said if you stopped investing in innovation in one product cycle, you'd be out of business.
Yes.
So talk to us about the importance of innovation to a company like JCI.
So take lightweight, for example, a very important factor for our customers. We have introduced a lightweight door panel technology in a 2012 model of a German OEM customer. It has an area weight of 1,850 grams per square meter. That was not light enough to win the next order. That went into production. This was a competitor to that vehicle. It went into production in 2014. That technology was not, that had 1,400 grams per square meter. It was not light enough to win the next order. And now we're targeting this successor of the first vehicle that had an area weight of 1,850 grams. We're now looking at 1,000 grams per square meter in order to win that piece of business, which is very important for us. So if we would not innovate in lightweight technology, we would never win the next generation of vehicles.
How do you achieve that without driving up cost? I mean, it's one thing to go with lightweight materials, yep, a lot of carbon fiber and the like.
Yep.
But in this industry, as you know, they want it all and they want you to cut cost.
Totally. So it's obviously... reducing material is not just taking out weight, but it's also taking out cost, because 50 to 70% of our bill of material is material. So it's smart engineering, it's designing for lightweight, it's integrating process steps in our plant, going from 10 steps to 2 steps. It's lowering the capital investment by combining a lot of things. It's complicated, but it's doable.
You know, it's interesting, you have the responsibility for advanced product development, and then there's that ampersand in the word sales.
Right.
How do you balance the blue sky thinking that's necessary for advanced product development and yet bring it down to earth such that you've got to sell things and make a profit?
So to me, the connection is totally logical, because the connection between innovation and sales allows us to engage more strategically with our customers, not just about the next program that goes into production, but we spend time with our customers' leadership that thinks about the next generation of vehicles. So it helps us prepare strategically our product portfolio that will meet their requirements and expectations for the next generation. Mm-hmm. So who's a better salesman of the food than the chef, right?
You know, it's interesting. You're talking about lightweighting these interiors, and then we're going to go to autonomous cars, and people are going to be putting beds and microwaves and television sets and all that inside.
Yeah.
You exactly. Have a lot of power, need a lot of power outlets.
Yeah, right. Well, it's going to be the case, because the value proposition of autonomous driving is zero accidents. So think about all the money that we spend today on safety functions and features, from airbags to crash zones, to ABS, you name it. That money will be invested somewhere else. And when you're driving in an autonomous vehicle, horsepower is less important, because you can do better things with your time than drive the vehicle at that point.
Well, we still want to drive when the roads are good and there's no
exactly.
traffic.
When you want to have fun, you do that, but not on your commute to work.
Hans Hendrik, thanks so much for stopping by and sharing a little bit of the future with us.
Sure.
Just awesome.
Thank you.
Hey, we're going to be back in just a moment here, and we want to give a good shout out to our friends at Firestone.
Introducing a car company that's never made a single car. We took the power of a 9-year-old V8 and gave it the impressive handling of Firestone's Destination tire. Now, moms agree. Every milk run feels like a victory lap. So whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
Well, we're still in Traverse City. We're still sitting out in this warm sunshine with the Grand Traverse Resort in the background. And not only that, the cocktail party in the background. And that place looks packed back there.
It's getting full swing. Long day. They need a beverage.
We've got our next guest with us right now. Craig Wiggins is the Senior Vice President for Powertrains at Continental, and thanks for stopping by.
Oh, good afternoon. Thanks for asking me out.
So you've got a new turbocharger that you're beginning to implement on a vehicle. Tell us about that.
We do. Well, Continental is a very broad powertrain component and system supplier. We have a lot of innovative products And one of the products that we just recently introduced is an aluminum turbocharger. So we're relatively new in turbochargers. We've only been a couple, 3 years in production. We started on the Ford Fox engine, the 1 liter in Europe, which has already won 3 International Engines of the Year awards. So very, very terrific engine that Ford designed, and we hope to think we're a part of that too from the turbo side. But this latest turbo is an aluminum-based turbo.
Is that the first aluminum turbo?
It's the first aluminum in a passenger car.
And the whole housing, or is...
Yes, the...
Even the hot side from the exhaust?
The hot side from the
exhaust. Really? So that's got to be the breakthrough, right, to
be
able to do that?
That's a breakthrough. You know, a conventional turbocharger, when you run it under a high load, it gets very hot, obviously. 700 degrees, it starts to glow. 900 degrees C is about... N plus is the operating range. But our aluminum water-cooled design limits it to about 120 degrees C. So for smaller engines, you know, from a system aspect, it provides quite a bit of benefit. It combines its lower cost because it's aluminum and not a stainless alloy. And at lower weight, 30% lower weight. And we also provide some system benefits as well.
So what would the material otherwise be that would be used to
deal with
that heat?
It would be a stainless alloy.
Stainless alloy.
So
that's
not,
so it's expensive material.
Not cast iron.
So it's an expensive material to begin with, and then machining of that is very difficult to do. So you'd have to cast and do some finished machining, more expensive. And you guys decided that aluminum would be better.
Aluminum is better. Of course, it's a system application. A few years ago, we wouldn't have been able to come up with this because of all the thermodynamic modeling and the integration with the exhaust and engine. But in this configuration, of course, you can save under the hood because of the heat shielding and the high temp components around it. But of course, it only works on smaller engines.
So this is a 1.5 liter engine that you're using it on.
1.5 liter in the BMW Mini.
So three-cylinder engine.
Three-cylinder, yes. 100 kilowatt output.
But I've got to believe Continental's going to do a family of turbochargers.
Well, we have a family of turbochargers. And in some applications, of course, the aluminum turbocharger may not be the right system solution.
So then that was my next question.
You have to go to a more conventional design. But in certain applications, if you can really optimize the vehicle around it, of course, you have to make some cooling system changes, et cetera. But in this configuration, they were able to give a good overall system cost benefit by going to this aluminum-based.
So by using the water jacket, you were able to attenuate a lot of the problems with heat. So do you see that going forward, that as you were designing turbochargers for 8-cylinder engines, 10-cylinder engines, that you would have the same sort of approach to designing it?
Well, of course, there's always a system trade-off. So you have to dissipate the heat in some way. And so for smaller engines, then you have that cooling overall cooling system capacity capability to dissipate the heat. In bigger engines, it may not be the right solution. We may have to go to a more conventional solution. Mm-hmm. And even some applications of this engine, we have a more conventional steel alloy mm-hmm. solution.
Mm-hmm. How's the turbo business going? And I ask that because it's very interesting to see Continental getting into the business. There's a few more competitors jumping
yes.
in. The car companies wanted this. They didn't like the fact there were only one or two big ones in the world. They wanted more competition.
Yes.
But of course, one of the reasons they wanted that is there's so many more turbo applications. But did they invite too many competitors, or is it just right, or did you wish that there were fewer?
Well, there's a lot of good players in turbos out there, but there's enough room because as you look at the whole downsizing turbo trend with direct injection, we see a 13% annual growth rate for turbos globally. So it's a very large growing faster than the business. I mean, every diesel basically has a turbo already, so those are organic and flat. But the gasoline penetration is growing so significantly that on the gasoline side, we see a much higher growth, but overall 13%. So there's room in the marketplace. And we think we have some very innovative solutions that allow us to grow faster, actually, than the growth of the turbo itself.
Now, presumably what you're involved with goes beyond just turbochargers within the powertrain operations at
Continental.
Well, in Continental,
we have a very broad portfolio. Uh-huh. So yes, we do a lot of engine, of course, combustion solutions, so turbos, electronics, fuel injection, wet side systems. We also, because of the trends that we see in emissions and fuel economy, or in the electrification space, so we see a big trend in light electrification, so 48-volt technology, but to provide you start-stop, provide you some sailing and coasting features, so you can gain anywhere from 5 to 15% fuel economy beyond just a conventional downsize engine application.
We're seeing some interesting applications in racing. At Le Mans, for example, using electric motors to help spin up the turbo,
yes.
Which almost sounds crazy to me, but do you see that coming for production cars?
Well, we have a lot of innovative solutions. There is that full e-charger system, and there's also, say, the e-compressor system, which has kind of a parallel compressor that allows you to get boost built before the turbo can spool up. So you kind of also shortens the turbo lag of the turbocharger.
Historically, we've seen mostly naturally aspirated engines. Do you think we're coming to the day where we'll see mostly turbocharged engines or some sort of supercharging and turbocharging?
I mean, what we see is clearly by 2025, well over a third of the U.S. will be turbocharged gasoline engines. Diesels, of course, that percentage
that's
will
100%.
Be 100%, but we'll see a well over 30% in the U.S. market 2025 gasoline, and globally it's certainly in a 20-25% range. So significant penetration.
So what's your sense when we go to 2025? Engines as we know them versus motors, electric motors driving vehicles, and what's the breakdown going to be?
We still predict a relatively smaller percentage of pure electric vehicles, so 2 or 3%. We say about 18% will be 48 volt, so a light assist, because many people think there's no way to get to our 54.5 miles per gallon in 2025 without a light assist. Mm-hmm. And by adding this 48 volt technology that we and others have, of course, to be able to provide this boost, and we think we can do it in a very cost-effective manner to help out. And of course, transmission controls. We just announced an Audi transmission control, which uses this bare die, high density interconnect solution, very small package, and it's the first one transmission control that actually has this ISO 26262, the highest level of certification, this ASIL-D. And as we see more and more complex system, automated driving, the more and more electronics connecting and talking to each other, this functional safety will be more and more prevalent. So we're first to there, too.
Well, geez, I wish I could buy turbo stock. That's what I wish
it sounds like Continental is as much an electronics company as it is a company that is making physical things like turbochargers.
Well, we have a broad portfolio, and certainly electronics are part of it.
Under the hood,
of the component side. We have a lot of innovative technologies on our turbo side as well.
Okay. Real good. Well, Craig Wiggins, thanks so much for stopping by and bringing us up to speed with all this turbocharging activity and some of the other stuff, too.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay,
real good.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, just amazing how much boosting of engines. Of course, it's all related to the downside.
Yeah, as people want greater fuel efficiency, they don't want to give it up thank you.
Thanks, Gary.
They don't want to give up performance, and so the turbocharged solution seems to be the one that is being widely embraced, and with good reason, because as you well know, it's a hell of a lot more fun to drive a turbocharged car than one that's naturally aspirated with a small displacement.
Exactly right. I can't wait to introduce our next guest here. Frank Zhao is from Tsinghua University. Did I pronounce that right?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Close enough, right?
Yeah,
what I also like is Sean McElinden from the Center for Automotive Research keeps introducing you as the Bob Lutz of China. And because you don't mind holding back in at all in what your opinions are of what's going on in this business.
Oh, okay. Well, I try to share as much as possible. That's why I called Frank, right?
Mm-hmm.
Frank always speaks frankly.
Yeah.
So you were very much stressing the fact that the Chinese market is growing tremendously in the next few years, and that it is very important for people who are companies in the United States to be on the ground and see exactly what's going on over there.
Yes, I mean, absolutely. You know, you do business and you can't miss a boat. That boat is getting bigger, faster, and right? So, and given the fact that 10 years ago I left Detroit, I really wanted Detroit to benefit from the rapid growth and in China. So.
And it pretty much has. I mean, General Motors is very strong.
Yes.
Air Ford is growing quickly.
Exactly. General Motors, like 33% of the global sales come from the Chinese market, and so is true for Volkswagen, and then Ford is picking up very quickly.
Fiat Chrysler, they've got some catching up to do there.
Well, they have more homework to do.
American suppliers, what do you think? Some are doing a good job. What's your overall view, though?
Well, I think in general, I mean, American suppliers are doing well, but they could do better, and if the American OEMs are doing well. I mean, you know, it's our with team up, right? I mean, you know, your suppliers go together with OEM, and then you can't do one way or the other, and so you need both.
So 2020, how many cars will there be in China?
Well, actually, depending on whom you're talking to, people tend to agree roughly 2020, it's 35 million.
But 35 still, million a year that
year.
Will be made. Then.
Yeah, exactly. But I still feel that sort of projection is too conservative. Mm-hmm. And 35 million from today's, last year we sold 22 million units. And that's only roughly annually like 6% increase.
And the market's growing far faster than that.
Yeah, looking at the last 10 years, almost on average more than like 18%. Even slowing down last year was still like 14%. Mm-hmm. And then depending on the years, some years, we were even seeing like 50%, increase. But if we really look like a 9% annual increase, then it will be reaching 40 million automatically.
And it's growing far more than 9% a year now.
Right now, so far.
When you say 40 million, you're including everything.
Yeah.
Heavy trucks, agricultural equipment, motorcycles too?
No. Okay. It's only for the four-wheelers.
So if you looked at just light vehicles, what would the number be?
There will be probably, if you really look, the 40 million, mm-hmm. if it's in total, then I think the passenger car will be probably 34.
Still gigantic.
Exactly.
And that's by 2020.
Yes. For example, looking at the last year, and the whole market was 22 million. Then 18 million were passenger car. Mm-hmm. And only 4 million from the commercial. And then the commercial sales almost stagnated during the last 5 years, just kind of 4 million around and just there. And then really look, the sort of construction and everything, I don't see a big increase in the commercial vehicles, but it's more the 1.3 billion people. They have the money, they want to drive a car, and then they are ready, and then that's really the market growth is all about.
You know, when we talk about the Chinese market, I think many people in the United States are just thinking that it's Beijing or some other large city. Now, in China, it's different, though. You were talking about there's various tier cities. Could you
exactly.
explain that to us?
I think, when we really talk about Beijing, Shanghai, we call it tier one, and then you really talk about some capital city for different province. And then those are the tier two.
And how many people would live in a tier two
city? Oh, Jesus. And if you're really looking at the tier two, we are talking about 5 million, people in those cities. Then you really talk about tier three, probably like 1 or 2 million people. Then you talk about tier four, it's really going to like a small village and so on. Then you talk about probably 500,000 populations.
Mm-hmm. So, but as Gary said, you've identified very clear consumer differences and tastes in cars between tier one and two and the threes, fours, and fives.
I think looking at the last 5 years, the tier one, tier two cities or class one, class two cities, the tastes are changing dramatically from the tier three and the tier four.
Give us some examples.
Well, I just looked at some of the market survey sort of results, and for the bigger city like Shanghai, Beijing, they started like a simple kind of, high tech. But then the tier four or tier three, tier four city, they like a colorful, eye-catching, still like seeing buying a car for the face. But then Shanghai, Beijing, they don't see that way anymore.
So people will buy the car because it shows that they have wealth, it shows that they've...
In the tier three, tier four
prosperous.
Cities, but then tier one, tier two, that's no longer the case anymore. They buy a car more for really, private commuting and so on. And a very interesting thing, it's not related to car, but it shows the change of the taste. For example, they said in the tier one cities, 5 years ago, they enjoyed, the girls enjoyed buying like a fake, an LV kind of bag. But now they want to buy the genuine sort of real ones. Then they were asked, why? 200 RMB, it's only like $30, and then you can get a one which you can't even tell the difference from the real sort of LV bag. Then the girl will tell you, well, yeah, the other don't know, but I do know this is the real, the other one is a fake. That means that they really care about the detail, the quality, the feeling of their heart, and not really the others just seeing themselves.
So there's a message in that for the automakers, too. You better be true to your brand.
Exactly. And then also, you treat your brands, serious, and also you have to really look at different segments or in the different tier cities, how the different. you know, you design a car for Shanghai people, then you may not be favored by the tier 3, tier 4 cities. And then, you know, you've designed for the urban city people, they like, you know, simple, kind of nice, sort of, you know, a little bit, you know, elegant. But then that may be treated as a kind of low kind of profile too much. Then they don't be respected.
So how well are the indigenous Chinese auto companies doing in China?
The local brands, I mean, the market share, you know, was okay in so far, but the last 10 months was really, you know, dropping consecutively. You know, almost each month lost a little bit. And right now, I think that's a big headache for the government and for the local executives.
China has really been pushing what it calls the new energy vehicles, especially electrics. They're not selling. I mean, this is a global issue, not just in China. But you're saying the Chinese government is going to keep pushing these electric cars no matter what, because it's a national security issue.
Well, I think the energy security is a bigger issue for such a big country. And, you know, they do realize all the challenges for EVs, you know, the cost, the durability, and then the infrastructure. But they do realize, I mean, you know, energy is far more important than go electric. It's the key solution and for the future, and not only for automobiles, but for the national security reason of the energy. That's why I think recently, you know, the president, the prime minister, they keep making, you know, they are, you know, voice out, say, you know, new energy vehicle is the future for China. And then all the government agencies do everything they could in terms of offering, you know, incentives, offering the tax benefit, and whatever they could to promote, you know, the mass production of EVs. That's a very clear signal from what I, you know, see in, from all the perspectives.
So is this across the country that this is important, or are they concentrating on Beijing and Shanghai?
No, I think they use Beijing or Shanghai, those bigger cities, as examples, but this is really across the nation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's the sort of energy solution sort of strategy, rather than say, hey, we just then do the hands waving. And I see that more clearly than it was 3 years ago.
So my understanding is that in 2020 that the largest luxury automobile market in the world will be in China.
Well, it's already.
So I'm just wondering, as we look at, you know, the new energy vehicles, one would seem to think that perhaps these are small electric vehicles and not very elegant and elaborate the way a large stretched sedan, and, you know, an S-Class or an A8 or something like that would be. So is there people in China who would say, well, forego having the luxury car to buy the new energy vehicle?
Well, I think for a while it will be difficult to get the EVs to sort of personal transportation segment. But giving all the efforts government are putting together to push forward for this technology into the market, I think for some specialty vehicles like logistics and then the buses, the public transportations, even sort of government usage of the vehicles, you're going to see a big increase then in the, you know, electric vehicles. Then with that, then the infrastructure getting better, and also, you know, the technology getting more mature, then I would expect a big increase in the personal segment. But it will take time. But for national strategy, you are not looking at 5 years or even 10 years down the road. With all the efforts into it, I think you're going to see a big difference 10 years down the road. But then, you know, during the process, I think each company will have to take different strategies. For, you know, some company may be good at designing smaller micro EVs, and then some are good at the, you know, mid-class. Some are maybe even pushing the luxury brands with, may not be just a pure EV, it could be, you know, plug-in hybrid and so on. Then I would say, you know, with the sort of pushing forward by the government, and then each company will follow with their own strategy, you're going to see a good mix. good mix.
Well, in fact, that was your advice to in your panel today to the automotive industry here, that you see plug-in hybrids as maybe offering the best opportunity right now.
Well, I mean, the reason I said that is, first of all, hybrid, it's a good to go kind of technology for fuel economy, regulation. And that's the 5-liter one in 2020, which conventional powertrain has a hard time to meet. Meanwhile...
So explain the 5-liter to what that means for our audience.
5-liter is the China Stage 4 fuel economy regulation. And that means by the NEDC cycle, and basically 100 kilometer fuel consumption has to be under 5-liter. Okay. We call CAFC, corporate average fuel consumption. It's not a fuel economy.
Yeah.
And then basically the whole industry already reached an agreement with conventional powertrain to reach 5-liter on CAFC. It's impossible. Then what's the available technology? Hybrid is the very quick fix for that number. But then the challenge is the cost. Mm-hmm. Then everybody's waiting for the subsidizer to get reimbursed for that cost. But to me, it's almost impossible. Mm-hmm. Then why, plug-in hybrid? Because plug-in hybrid is treated as a new energy technology by Chinese government.
So you get the subsidy.
Exactly. Then that will cover a certain cost of the investment, the technology, then and being favored by the government too. So by adding all them together, I think hybrid is a quick fix, but if you really wanted to get the subsidized from the government, then plug-in hybrid may have some role to play. It's a good balance of basically the cost of the technology and the advancement of the technology and also the acceptance by the customer. Mm-hmm. But the plug-in hybrid will reduce the dependence on the infrastructure, mm-hmm. in terms of charging. It's still needed, but it's not as much as the pure EVs, right? But it will be more than HEV, but still, you get the subsidized. So that's the whole why I'm saying plug-in hybrid may do something. But I think the other thing I want to add on to our American audience is the new regulation in China adopting, it's not a fuel economy improvement, it's a fuel consumption. So this regulation is favoring smaller vehicles, more challenging to bigger ones. On average, the fuel economy improvement from stage three to stage four is 30%. But for smaller ones, you only need to improve 17%.
Mm-hmm.
But for the bigger ones, like a 2.5 ton, 25 kilogram size of the vehicle, then you need 37%. So then for Americans, the Ford, GM, Chrysler, you build a big SUVs, pickups, and to be sold in China, that's a very challenging one. It's not how much you improve, it's how much you consume.
Yeah.
That's the key.
Key distinction there.
Yeah, that's a challenge. It's the CFC. That C means the difference from the E.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good point. Frank, thanks so much for stopping by. What a pleasure talking with you, and great insight as to what's going on in China.
It's good to be shared some opinions with you guys, and I enjoy it.
Very good.
Thank you, John.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're going to be back in just a minute, but first we got to go take a look at what our good friends at Hyundai have to say.
Nice. Not nice.
The new Elantra from Hyundai. Nice.
It's time again for the biggest movable feast of metal, that is. It's the Woodward Avenue Dream Cruise. Join John McElroy along with a million of his closest friends and eight lanes of classic cars, all coming to you on Friday, August 15th at 4 p.m. Eastern. It's the 2014 edition of Autoline Live from Woodward, where hot rods are welcome.
Still a beautiful, warm summer day, a nice breeze coming off the bay here in Traverse City.
A little more of the breeze would be fine for me.
Right.
It's getting really warm up here, and so we'd like to introduce to you this evening Dr. Mark White, who's the chief engineer of Body Complete Business Unit for Jaguar Land Rover. So welcome.
Thank you.
So explain this very complicated title that you have.
It's relatively simple. Basically, my department's responsible for all the structure, the sheet metal, and then pretty much anything that attaches to the sheet metal. So things like convertible top systems, glass, wipers, locks and those sort of things. Mm-hmm. So pretty much anything that attaches to the body comes under the Body Complete mm-hmm. business unit.
And these days, of course, you're talking aluminium.
Aluminum.
All right, we got them converted.
I'm bilingual.
Okay, but we say these days. Now. Here, we're all excited about the aluminum F-150.
Absolutely.
You guys, how many years have you been using aluminum to build Jaguars?
We started way back in 1922.
Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So pretty much aluminum is part of our DNA and our history. The modern era of aluminum that I've been lucky enough to lead and develop, we started in 2002 with the XJ. But there was probably about 10 years before that of research and development into, you know, could we do a production aluminum car in volume to the quality we needed for a Jaguar.
As far out as you can see, do you think Jaguar would do anything but an aluminum vehicle these days?
I think we're going to see a move towards aluminum intensive cars. So I don't necessarily see that every car that comes out of either JLR or other manufacturers will be 100% aluminum, because I think steel certainly has its uses, especially the high-strength steels, the borons and the DPs. But I think aluminum's got a lot to offer in terms of real, genuine weight saves. You know, the car industry's been trying to lose weight for the last 20 years, and until you substitute steel for a lighter material, you don't really save a great amount of weight. You can save 10%, maybe 20% if you're really, really efficient with the high strength steels, but that doesn't get you the sort of weight saves you need to get to the CAFE and the CO2 legislation of the future. So,
but if we look at the auto industry as it exists, at least in this country today and in England, besides your company, you know, it's basically predicated on welding, stamping, you know, and doing the stamping in certain ways mm-hmm. with dry, the draws being known and so on. You guys had to probably learn a number of lessons before you were able to implement aluminum.
Absolutely. That's what that 10 years of research and development before we started the XJ in 2002 was all about. You know, we really did look into, could we convert a steel factory and steel, what we would call bill of process, into an aluminum bill of process without throwing the press shop away, without throwing the body shop away, without throwing the paint shop away. Trim and final was relatively easy, so that was pretty straightforward. But even then, there was challenges in the trim and final. So the real challenge for us was just learning about the processes and making sure those processes were robust. You probably know we actually don't weld any of our structure. It's all bonded and riveted, just like an aircraft or a ship. But we had to take that technology, which is quite a slow technology, and turn it into a high volume automotive technology. And Ford are using that technology, a number of other OEMs are using that technology, and we know we can get to very high volumes with that technology now.
So you're saying that the throughput of your facility now is faster than the throughput of a plant were you to be using steel. Is that correct?
Yeah, essentially so. We think we can build an aluminum car as quick or quicker than a steel conventional spot welder car.
And why is that?
Well, number one, we've really focused on part integration. So we've got less parts in our aluminum cars than we would in a conventional steel car.
Could you do that in steel?
You could probably do some of it. But things like the casting, you know, the castings are wonderful things because you can take about half a dozen parts and just integrate them into one. You can't really do that in steel. So there's some things you can do in steel, but that's probably not one of them. And then the other thing is we use a lot less rivets. So typically a sedan car would have 5,000 spot welds. We've got about 2,500 spot weld rivets in the new XE, for example.
So these are self-piercing rivets robotically applying.
Robot applied and fully automated.
And is every joint adhesively bonded as well?
Not every joint. So we've got a CAA optimization tool that basically shows us where's the most effective place to put the adhesive. The adhesive and the rivets really complement each other because the rivets give you very good local strength, but the adhesives give a good global strength. So for things like stiffness and durability, adhesive really wins. Adhesive is not great in peel. appeal, as you probably know. So putting the rivet in effectively acts as a peel stopper. So you get the best of both worlds, and you get very stiff, very durable, but also very safe from a crash point of view.
Mm-hmm. Jaguar is already working on its 3-series fighter, and I think it's been officially announced that that's going to be aluminum intensive as well.
Indeed, yeah. So it's in the press. I've even done a small YouTube video, which is quite interesting. Give my kids a bit of a laugh anyway.
So what can you tell us about this car?
Not a lot, because it's still embargoed. So all I can say is it's called the XE. It's aluminum intensive, and it's a great car.
And it will be the only one in the class when it comes out that's going to be aluminum intensive, at least that we know of?
I think that's the case. I mean, the whole car industry, especially the premium automakers, are looking at lightweight and getting to that CO2 target and getting to that CAFE target. So we're probably just leading the way, you know. I think you'll see more and more use of aluminum, magnesium, composites in the premium segment, but also starting to come into the large truck and SUV segment as well.
So do you think that, I mean, one of the things that people had said for a number of years is that a Jaguar is a premium vehicle, therefore it can have a premium material, versus if we were talking about an ordinary sedan that is, you know, a mass market manufacturer. Do you think that aluminum lends itself to vehicles that are not premium?
Yeah, I do. I honestly think the advantages of lightweight, there is no downside apart from the material cost. And we're working very hard with the aluminum producers, Novelis and Alcoa and Hydro and people like that, to drive the cost of this technology down so that you know, as soon as we get anywhere close to the cost of a steel car, then it's a no-brainer. You know, you're just going to switch. But we already see aluminum hoods widely used throughout the industry.
Sure.
And we'll see aluminum doors, probably aluminum roofs, all starting to appear on what I would call mass market cars.
What are your thoughts on carbon fiber? At this conference, there's been a lot of attention on the i3.
Sure.
And are you thinking about maybe experimenting along those kinds of lines where you do a very carbon fiber intensive car?
So we've already done a couple of carbon fiber intensive cars. So we did a concept car called CX75, and the body on that was pretty much all
beautiful
carbon.
Beautiful car, by the way,
it was
too.
A fantastic car. I did have the privilege and pleasure to be able to drive it just briefly. So it did everything it said on the box. So, but I think if you look at carbon fiber, and the F-Type that we've brought here for display has a carbon fiber roof and a carbon fiber tailgate, it's a great material. And yes, you can save more weight than you can with a light metal such as aluminum or magnesium. But we've still got big recycling issues with carbon fiber. We've still got big energy cost issues in terms of manufactured carbon fiber. And you know, we've worked very hard with the aluminum industry to match supply and demand and make sure there's always enough aluminum. Right now, if someone decided they wanted to do a large volume carbon fiber car, the infrastructure and the raw material manufacture just isn't there.
You have to own your own carbon fiber company, which is what BMW went out and did.
And that's an expensive thing to do. And it's not only expensive, but again, you're throwing the factory away.
Sure.
You know, you can't use your press shop, you can't use your paint shop, can't really use your trim and final. Everything has to change. And so for a large scale automotive manufacturer to just throw all of that investment and all of that infrastructure away and say, hey, let's make carbon fiber cars, is going to be a difficult decision. You know, I think that we're going to have to have maxed out the use of light metals before we wholesale move to carbon fiber. But I do see its application in sports cars, in where ultimate weight save is needed, like in an F1 car or an airplane.
You mentioned hoods and roofs. What about structural elements? Have you thought about playing around with that in carbon fiber?
Yeah, I actually think using carbon in the structure is probably more inert and probably a better application. So I think if you can avoid, if you like, the bits that get bashed around and damaged, you know, and make those perhaps out of aluminum. So maybe the car of the future is a mixed material car, but it's maybe aluminum and carbon fiber with a bit of high strength steel where we absolutely need to use it.
So, and where would that be for in the doors for crash?
Yeah, I think you could use boron for the intrusion beams. You could use high-strength steel in the pillars. But carbon fiber can do a lot of that stuff. So I think it's just getting the mixture.
Would it be more cross members in the chassis?
Yeah.
Or the structure, I should say. We shouldn't say chassis any longer, should we?
No, I mean, I think, you know, we've all moved away from the body on frame to the integrated monocoque construction. And I think, or we're moving away anyway. Some of the trucks are still that way. I do find it ironic that the BMW is a little bit of a body-on-frame car.
It very much is. So, no, it sits on an aluminum frame.
So if the answer in steel is a monocoque, I'm pretty sure the answer in aluminum and in carbon fiber is monocoque too. But we'll see. I don't have a crystal ball with me.
So when you go to places where there are other body engineers from other companies and they know what you have done, what are the sorts of things that they're curious to learn from you?
It's a small industry, so we get together relatively often. There's a couple of events like this event here, the car event, super event, and I would say, you know, it's a world class event. There's another event in Germany called Euro Car Body, and all the body engineers of the world get together a couple of times a year and really compare notes, you know. And it's not about copying each other, or it's not about you know, what's Fred done and what's Joe done. It's about actually moving the industry forward. And you might not adopt everything that you learn at these forums, but it certainly allows you to put what you're doing into perspective, and make sure that check that you're, you know, you've got the most efficient body. So it's great to benchmark yourself against, you know, the Mercedes and the BMWs and the Audis and the Lexuses of this world, and know, are you lighter, are you stiffer, you know, those sort of things. You know, it's a bit geeky, but it's fun.
Uh-huh. Okay, Gary asked about your competitors, what about your customers? Are they even aware that these cars are aluminum, or what kind of customer feedback are you getting?
It's a really good point, because, you know, our mantra when we first started this journey was to make it invisible to the customer that their cars were made from aluminum, because really they don't care what their cars are made from. You know, it's not something that, you know, gets them out of bed in the morning. What they do care about is performance, fuel economy, and CO2. So if you can give them a better proposition for those things, so you can give them the cake and eat it, if you like, you know, give them a light, fast car that's also good for the environment, they're going to be pleased with that. So I think it's not about selling aluminum. You know, if you made a heavy aluminum car, that would be a bad thing to do.
Do you get better damping, NVH, or are there other characteristics that maybe the customer isn't aware that aluminum is doing that, but love the car?
Yeah, a really good tangible example of that is safety, because, you know, people think of Coke cans. Well, Coke cans are made from very, very thin aluminum, so yeah, I wouldn't compare a car with a can. But aluminium absorbs more energy per kilo than steel does. And by making big weight savings in the body, imagine you've got two objects hitting each other. There's only two things that's going to affect the outcome of that. It's how heavy they are and how fast they're going. Now, we can't affect how fast people drive, but we can take the weight down, and that takes less energy into the accident. And it's safer for the person that's got the car, the lightweight car, and safer for the other car or other vehicle or pedestrian that car hits. So that's a tangible example that we don't really talk about, but is an extra benefit for the customer.
I imagine, too, that there had to be a lot of planning going into dealerships being able to repair these cars as well, because, as you well know, just as it's different to design, engineer, and manufacture, it's a whole different process to repair these vehicles as well.
Absolutely. One of the reasons we took 10 years to get the car on the road is we didn't want to put a car on the marketplace that, you know, guaranteed the first time the first customer drives it out of the showroom, someone's going to run into him or he's going to run into something. So we wanted the infrastructure to be in place. So we did what we call bolt-on-bolt off-repair system. So the front end and the rear end of the car, and all the bits that can get damaged easily can be simply bolted off and bolted on. So regardless of the material cost of the parts that you're making, if you can replace them quickly, actually the body shop labor time becomes the dominant factor. So we actually got lower repair times on the aluminum cars than we had from the previous steel cars.
And it's because you
designed for disassembly. Absolutely.
So you're designing for assembly to make it easier for them to put it together in the shop, but you're also designing it
absolutely
to be disassembled in the service bay.
In the aftermarket, yeah.
So I've got to ask you, so when Ford was thinking about doing the aluminum F-150, did you start getting a lot of phone calls from your former colleagues at Ford?
I don't think I can comment on that. I think
that means he did.
I'm just gonna say that I've worked very closely with my Ford colleagues for many years. I think what they've done with the 150 is fantastic. I think it's going to be a very, very successful truck. And you know, I'm glad to see it added to the growing collection of aluminum vehicles on the road.
So do you feel a little bit of validation that you guys were going down the right road?
I feel very, very proud for Ford. Uh-huh. And I think that clearly we're obviously not the only ones that have reached the same conclusion. You know, we've seen all the sports cars go aluminum, you know, the Ferraris and the Lamborghinis and all those type of vehicles. And we've seen the big premium luxury cars go to either aluminum or aluminum intensive. Mm-hmm. The trucks have to go aluminum just to get to the cafe mileage. They have to either downsize the trucks, or most people want to keep the full-size trucks, so they've got to find a way of shedding significant weight. And I think Ford shed over 700 pounds of
right.
the F-Series.
That's mm-hmm. right. Hey, thanks so much for stopping
no problem.
By. Very interesting discussion.
Thank
Love
you.
The fact that you were able to come in and fill us in. And I can't wait to drive that XE when it comes out. I mean, I like all the Jags out now, but that's going to put that car in a class by itself, I think.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Real good. So, Gary, pretty interesting, getting people from all different kinds of viewpoints at this conference.
You know, and I think the theme, whether we're talking about the aluminum Jaguars, or we're talking about the developments that are going on in China, or we're talking about the developments that Continental is making.
Aluminum turbos.
But under the hood and the transmission controller that they developed, and we're talking to the JCI about how they're seeing the future of vehicles and autonomy. And, I mean, right across the board, we've seen innovation, innovation, innovation. That seems to be the theme, that if you're in this industry, you know, you can't rest on your laurels, because there are very, very strong competitors out there who are investing a lot of time, effort, energy, and money in making some fantastic products, whether it's a component like a turbocharger or the XE.
Yeah, to me, that's the value of this conference. It's not a conference where you get shattering breaking news that you got to go, oh, stop the presses. It's, you know, all the technical things that we've talked about. They've been doing sales forecasts, all kinds of customer trend things. How do you get new talent into the industry? So to me, it's been pretty worthwhile being here.
Absolutely. And it's beautiful.
And it's lovely to be out overlooking the bay. Well, with that, we're going to wrap it up and want to thank you for having joined me here. Want to thank all of you who have joined us for this show, and we'll be back doing the show, but not here, again next week.
No show next week. Woodward.
Oh, that's right. Next week is the Woodward Dream Cruise. And are you sure that's next week?
I'm sure.
We'll eventually be back in the studio.
We're talking off camera too with my producer, Chip Drake, here. But, yeah, tune in next week. We'll be here.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion. And by Hyundai. See what makes Elantra so nice. Check out its style, interior space, fuel economy, and popular features now.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.